everybody, this is Paul from the future, and this is the Long Lost Teen Titans episode. Before I start the episode, I want to point out a few things. This recording was fraught with issues. There were interruptions and construction noises and Wi-Fi cutting out and dogs howling. It was a real mess, I can tell you. So putting this together was a bit of a struggle, but the main Titans discussion came out pretty good, I think. And now there are some audio kerfuffles here and there, but I did my best to clean it up, and I hope it will be enjoyable to everyone. So sorry about the delay, and without further ado, Teen Titans.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the most famous and infamous comic book runs and story arcs throughout the history of the medium. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Mr. Brian K. Reese.
Hi, Paul. I'm really happy to be here with you today.
Excellent. Fantastic.
This is a good day. This is a good comic. Everything is going to be coming up roses. Roses, Paul. Roses.
Okay. Everything is awesome.
Everything is cool when you're part of a team.
That's true. Well, today on the program, we'll be discussing the iconic storyline from the new/Tales of the Teen Titans, The Judas Contract, written by Marv Wolfman with art by George Perez and published by DC Comics. But first, well, there's not a lot going on in news this week. With New York Comic Con coming up, it seems that publishers and studios are holding off any major announcements. But Brian, Brian, you had a great idea that you floated to me before we started recording, which was,
folks don't know who our favorite characters are. I mean, I think they've figured out at this point, all 50 to 60, 70,000 fans of ours have figured out that by this point that you are generally a Marvel guy and I am generally a DC guy with a lot of crossover in between. But yes. People don't know, who are Paul and Brian's favorite characters? What characters do Paul and Brian follow? What characters do Paul and Brian love? What characters defined the childhoods and adult lives of Paul and Brian?
Wow.
And I think this is important information for our plethora of fans.
Yes. People need to know, basically.
People need to know.
Well, this is your idea. You begin.
Okay. Well, when I think of characters that I love, they are often characters that, for the most part, were some of the first characters I experienced when I was reading comics. Now, going forward, I've adopted new characters that I love and care about and follow. But at the same time, there are certain characters, there are certain story arcs or what have you, that tend to hold on to our hearts or minds or intellect more strongly than other characters. So for me, I compiled a list, and lists are important. How do we not love lists? Lists are a beautiful thing.
Well, I'll give you 5 reasons why I like lists.
Exactly. Thank you. And for me, so I compiled a list of like my 5 favorite characters.
Well, I am unprepared.
It's because I can't choose. It's like choosing my 5 favorite records of all time. Like, I'll list 5 records,
but I reserve
the right in 10 minutes to change that list. So the same with sort of these characters, although there are a few here that I would hold on to as still abiding characters. So for me, if I were to list my top 5 favorite characters, in no order, this is not in order, I would say Beast, Doctor Strange, Daredevil, Swamp Thing, and John Constantine the Hellblazer.
Wow, Marvel, 3 out of 5.
Exactly, which is very interesting, isn't that?
That is.
Yeah. Indeed. Everybody's going to say Batman.
Yeah.
And I love Batman. But, you know, I love Batman, but everybody loves Batman. We all read Batman. Batman's Batman. But if I had to pick the 5 characters who I am most excited about a new series featuring, it would be those 5.
Wow, that's very cool. Do you have reasons for each one?
I do have reasons for each one. We could go into that, but I would be curious to hear yours first.
Well, I did not prepare a list of five. I could probably do it off the top of my head, though. I have mentioned on this program ad infinitum that Captain America is my favorite character. So I won't rehash all the reasons why, but
America.
So Captain America for sure. I would actually put Doctor Strange on there. The Fantastic Four, Spider-Man. That's probably cliche. Everyone would say Spider-Man.
Spider-Man is like Batman.
Yes, but Spider-Man had a huge impact on me growing up. I read the comics. I watched the TV show. He was a teen, not just, and he wasn't an old guy billionaire, because I wasn't that, but I was a teen who was, or a young kid who was awkward.
You were a teen with issues.
Yes, I was a teen with issues. Or tissues, as some say.
Or tissues. Tissues.
But one of my all-time favorite characters is Man-Thing.
Again with the tissues.
Yes. Man-Thing, the swamp monster / penis innuendo that was very popular in the 70s.
So Man-Thing, so you have Captain America and Man-Thing.
Yep.
Spider-Man,
Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four was the first comic I ever had a subscription to. It was given to me on my seventh birthday. And every month I got a Fantastic Four comic in the mail, and it was just great.
Oh, remember when we could order stuff through the mail?
Yeah.
You could subscribe. We could do that now. I understand there's platforms where you can pre-order your comics or whatever, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same as like when I got my latest issue of G.I. Joe in the mail, instead of having to go to the 7-Eleven or Lawson's or insert whatever your local, dairy / convenience store was.
Yeah, mine was Wawa, and anyone who lives on the East Coast knows what a Wawa is. Anyone else just says, you're just making a noise.
And everybody from Ohio knows what Lawson's is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it was really great to live in a row home in Philly with the little mail slot on the door, and that comic would slide through the mail slot.
Oh, yeah.
And land, and it was just amazing. So Fantastic Four has a very, they're very near and dear to my heart, as does Spider-Man. Yeah, I really loved horror comics as a kid, too. So we always got, Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night, Ghost Rider. Anything that was macabre, I just gravitated towards.
Which would include Doctor Strange.
Yes, I did mention Doctor Strange, actually.
Yes, you did. But that confirms, both you and I loving Doctor Strange, because he was a character that he had no superpowers. Everything he did was magical. I mean,
yeah,
he was kind of an ass in real life and as a superhero, but he did these crazy wacky stuff. I mean, I remember reading the Defenders when he was with the Defenders.
Mm-hmm.
And besides the fact that you got those onomatopoeic spells
by the crimson bands of Sidorak, whatever,
by the hoary hosts of Hogarth, whatever it was. But I really loved that stuff, and I loved the art that went around Doctor Strange, because whoever the artist was tasked with making kind of pseudo-psychedelic.
Yeah, it was both magical and cosmic at the same time.
Right. I mean, it was LSD before we knew what LSD was.
Indeed. Yeah, that was really just an amazing... As a kid, to engulf yourself into that world, it was more than just your everyday superheroes fighting on the street.
Right.
Something like that was magical. It was, otherworldly. Yeah, it was otherworldly and mind expanding to keep the LSD thing going.
And it blew my mind as an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid. Like, I would see Doctor Strange. It would be like, what the hell is this? I don't even understand half of what is happening on this panel. But my God, there's some things that give me feelings.
Well, that's the same thing I have with, that's the same feeling I have with Man-Thing.
And Swamp Thing. I love the fact that we both have a thing.
That's right. Well,
I have a Man-Thing and I have a Swamp Thing.
Yeah. The thing with Man-Thing that for me, I mean, it's written by Steve Gerber, who, if anyone knows who Steve Gerber is, knows that he was pretty out there with his storylines. And different from Swamp Thing, Man-Thing didn't have a personality. He was a blank slate that just felt... He acted as a conduit through which other stories are told around him. I mean, it didn't, and not every story needed to be about him, but he always played a part in those stories, if that makes sense.
Well, he was the watcher, and I don't mean watcher as a character, but he was the observer. He affected
to a certain
the
extent
outcome of things
because he was empathic,
but not through will.
because he was empathic, he was able to highlight and strengthen others' emotions around him. But the major thing is how those stories were told. And this is why it had such an impact on me. I mean, yes, it was a big swamp monster and there was crazy, mystical, weird stuff going on in these stories. But they were always told in a narrative way that was unique and interesting. And right. That had a huge impact on me on how I read, how I absorb stories, and how I tell stories now. That of any comic, really, that really had an impact on me that still stays with me to this day. And if you'd like to know more about that, I can give you a
why, Paul, is there, you know what would be really interesting is if someone had a podcast that dealt with Man-Thing.
Well, actually, there is a podcast called Nexus of All Realities, which is a Man-Thing podcast. It could be
found. Can you repeat that again? Because I think I spoke over it.
It's called Nexus of All Realities, and it could be found at nexusofallrealities.com. And it's also available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
So there is a Man-Thing podcast.
There is. This is, in fact, a shameless plug that I started this podcast about a year ago. And I'm going issue by issue, talking about each Man-Thing comic, starting with Tales to Astonish. I like you. Savage Tales is where he started. But anyway.
So for me, now that the shameless plug is over,
yes,
which we're basically working towards for the past few minutes. So we've covered Doctor Strange. Like, for me, one of my favorite characters, like, I love Swamp Thing. Again, some of the ones I mentioned, we talked about Doctor Strange. Daredevil is a whole podcast in and of itself in terms of why I love Daredevil. But part of me always comes back to the Beast.
Which is interesting to me.
Hank McCoy. And the reason for me that the Beast, aka Hank McCoy, is one of my favorite characters is because my first entry into comics was the Avengers run that featured Beast. It was particularly Beast and Wonder Man. You could always try to figure out who is an Avenger at any given time. But obviously, we had Thor and Captain America, but then there were a lot of B and C listers like Moonstone and Valkyrie and, well, frankly, Beast and Wonder Man. What I remember reading, my first experience really digging into and following a series was that Avengers run that had the Beast in it. And I absolutely loved the interaction between Beast and Wonder Man in that series.
Beast was sort of a snarky kind of guy back then.
Right. He was a more humorous character at the time. And I have very strong issues. I've got issues with how Beast is being treated.
You mean today?
Today, in current continuity. I think that for whatever reason, Marvel has dictated to their writers, or the writers have dictated to Marvel, or let's be honest, nobody in Marvel is talking to anybody else in Marvel, and they're just putting out things that nobody is interested in. But the way Beast has been treated in the last 4 or 5 years has just been horrible, to the point where, like, what in the latest Secret Empire Nazi Steve Rogers, whatever the hell it was that they were trying to, like, achieve with this series, they made Beast one of the worst of all collaborators.
Yeah, well, it just seems...
And he's been treated badly before this in terms of, like, how he's been treated in the X-Men. I don't know what they're doing with him.
Well, it seems to me that Marvel is actually going out of its way to destroy its good characters.
Someone at Marvel actively hates Hank McCoy. Is the only thing I can figure out.
It's not, I mean, if it's any consolation, it's not just Hank McCoy. Someone at Marvel hates every single character and is going out of their way. I mean, they ruined Captain Marvel. They ruined Captain America. Yeah, I could go on and on. Hopefully something will change since they are rebooting again.
Right. With the exact same creators.
No, there are some.
Moving them around to different titles.
Yeah, well, maybe sometimes a title doesn't quite fit. I don't know what's going on with Marvel right now, but hopefully they'll get their act together and bring it back. But, you know, Doctor Strange was a fantastic run for a little while. That was one of the highlights of the last few years.
Jason Aaron's writing.
Jason Aaron's writing, yes.
I actually initially was a little skeptical about what Dead is Hopeless took over. And we're going to get, is it Donny Cates taking over?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
Dennis Hopeless took over for the Secret Empire tie-in. And as it continued to play out, and the fact that it really had nothing to do with Secret Empire, crazy ass fun. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be a really fun arc, and I understand that he's not finishing the series, someone else is taking over, but wow.
Okay, that's great to hear, because I have to admit, I dropped off of Doctor Strange after Jason Aaron, just because I needed to, you gotta spend your money in a certain place.
Right. It's worth reading. Maybe it'll come out in a trade. The run makes no sense.
That's fine. It's Doctor
Strange. And it shouldn't make any sense.
That's, you know, that harkens back to what the original run of Doctor Strange was all about, including being written by Marv Wolfman.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned Marv Wolfman.
Yes. Convenient segue.
Would that be an interesting segue, Paul?
Well, it just so happens that today's collected edition, we'll be talking about the new Teen Titans / Tales of Teen Titans, won by Marv Wolfman and George Perez.
Wow. It almost feels like I recommended that.
You did indeed. Why don't we talk about that? But first, let's take a quick break.
You like cheap comic books, right? Well, I'm Professor Allen, and I talk about cheap comic books on the Quarterbin Podcast. In every episode, I'll dissect a single comic from my collection, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for the issue. Forget about $4 new comics that you can read in 4 minutes, or crossover events that can cost $100 to collect. Join me in the Quarterbin, where even bad comics are a bargain, and good ones are a steal. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Visit us at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search Relatively Geeky or Quarterbin Podcast in iTunes. I guarantee it'll be worth every penny.
And we're back. Now, on today's program, we'll be talking about the new Teen Titans. Brian, take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Since this is my recommendation, here's what I have to say.
Good.
I'm sure that will be cut at some point. Today we're discussing Marv Wolfman and George Perez's classic run on the new Teen Titans, focusing on the Judas Contract, widely believed to be the finest arc in the series. Wolfman and Perez's collaboration is notable for introducing new characters in Cyborg, Raven, Terra, Jericho, and Starfire, reinventing Beast Boy as Changeling, and breathing new life into Donna Troy / Wonder Girl. It also sets the stage for their future work in some little comic event called Crisis on Infinite Earths. For our collected edition purposes, we will be using the new trade from DC, which contains the new Teen Titans issues 39 and 40, Tales of the New Teen Titans issues 41 through 44, and Annual number 3. The first three issues, while not the Judas Contract proper, serve as prologue, with the Titans battling Brother Blood and Mother Mayhem, Wally West retiring as a Titan and as Kid Flash, and the revelation that Terra is a traitor and spy working with Deathstroke the Terminator in a plot to take down the Titans. Most notably, Dick Grayson announces he will no longer be Robin, retires his costume, and begins his search for a new superhero persona. In issues 42 through 44, and annual number 3, we get the Judas Contract proper, wherein Deathstroke the Terminator captures the Titans, all the Titans, but Dick, and delivers
and 10-year-old boys, and activate.
Captures all the Titans but Dick, and delivers them to Hive, the hierarchy of international vengeance and extermination. He does this to fulfill a contract begun by his son, Grant Wilson, also known as the Ravager. Dick Grayson does some detective work, battles ensue, and the good guys win in the end. But tragically, of course, the traitorous and insane Terra dies, buried under a pile of rubble that she herself has constructed. While this seems a rather simplistic plot frame, it is the myriad of underlying stories that make this arc so important and enjoyable. Robin becomes Nightwing! Deathstroke gets his origin story. Jericho, son of Deathstroke, is introduced to great effect. All of the Titans have private and interpersonal moments that help humanize them. And George Perez does the very artwork of God.
Okay, nice hyperbole.
Well, George Perez.
It was absolutely brilliant work.
George Perez, I don't think he's underrated. There's no way that at this point in time you could call George Perez underrated. I think the only way you could call him underrated is by comparing him to contemporary artists that folks love who don't have a history of comics. You know, people are like, oh, Frank Cho is great, or insert whatever artist of your choice.
Rob Liefeld. No, I kid.
Oh, God bless Rob Liefeld. He just couldn't do feet.
Yes.
He loved pouches.
He had his head in the stars and his feet on the ground.
He had his head in a pouch and his feet somewhere.
Behind a rock somewhere. So behind a rock somewhere. Let's stop putting down Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, bless his heart.
He seems to have a good sense of humor.
He's actually like an engaging personality in social media.
Yes.
So,
George Perez, I agree. Absolutely stunning artwork. If I have any criticism of his work, it's that when he draws curly hair on a man, it looks really strange.
And like, that's where you're going with George Perez art.
Come on, if that's the only thing I can find as a negative towards him.
But I think one of the most impressive, and we saw this particularly in many ways, this series is the precedence to Crisis on Infinite Earths. But what Perez does, like, I tried to count how many panels Perez drew on any given page. And this is non-scientific, but we have between 8 to 13 to 14 panels per page. And some of them are his famous slice panels, you know, those tiny little...
Well, yeah, there's like, he puts a page together like a mosaic.
Right.
Long, short, small, close-up, panoramic. It's really dynamic page layouts.
Right. But within a slice, within these tiny little panels that he does, he includes so much detail. Even in the tiniest slice of a panel, the level of detail is astonishing.
Yeah, there's no washed out backgrounds here.
Right.
Yeah.
And this cat did it on a monthly basis for years.
Yeah.
I think George Perez actually is like, and I'm not just talking this new Teen Titans arc, but I'm talking as a career, should be heralded as one of the great illustrators. I mean, he should be Kirby level.
I think he is. I mean, I think he is respected in that way. You know, not just this, but also his Wonder Woman run was...
Oh, his Wonder Woman run. I mean, there's so many great runs that Perez has worked on. And every one of them is almost universally worshipped.
It's truly fantastic.
Yeah. So I think it's really important to recognize the contribution of George Perez and the way he defined this run that he and Marv Wolfman did on the new Teen Titans.
Yes, well, we've talked about before how, you know, this is, of course, a collaborative medium. And when an artist and a writer are on the same page, when they're working in sync with each other, the story just expands beyond, becomes more than what it is. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, Marv Wolfman has actually spoken about, they eventually ended up living within five blocks of each other. And Marv Wolfman has spoken about, at some point, he considered George Perez the co-writer of the series. They lived, at some point, there's an interview out there where he talks about how they lived within five blocks of each other, and they would basically meet for lunch every day and plot out an entire issue of whatever it was that they were working on. And Marv Wolfman considered George Perez a co-writer, not just a artist who was presenting his ideas on the page.
Yeah, that's when comics are at their best. That's, you know, that's the way it works. I mean, when I don't want to use the word simpatico, but I guess I'm going to, when the artist and writer are simpatico, and they're just, you can't tell where one stops and the other one begins, you get something truly astounding.
Right.
And this is one of those collaborations that that's exceptional.
Well, I think that because of the collaboration between Wolfman and Perez, that the entirety of the run on New Teen Titans that they worked on together is considered some of the best comics, period, that we've seen.
Yes, I agree. And as with many stories of this time, it's a culmination of years of storytelling.
Right.
You know, so and I think that's something that's missed in today's style of comics with you know, endless reboots and rebirths and new number ones.
A new number one every year.
Yeah. Is that you don't get that continuing story, that soap opera style, where we're invested not only with the story arc, but also in the lives of the characters.
Well, and it's interesting that you say the continuation or the soap opera aspect, because I think, like, with the New Teen Titans, there is a little bit of, as a DC guy, I hate to admit this, there's a little bit of a Marvel thing going on here.
I don't think you should be upset by that. I mean, Marv Wolfman did work for Marvel for years right. and years and worked in the Marvel method.
But with the New Teen Titans throughout the entire arc, there was you had the thoughts and feelings of each character, and you had the daily life of each character. You don't get that with Superman or Batman at that time. You know, DC had been pretty fallow for a good almost two decades. I mean, a lot of DC stuff through the late 60s, through the 70s, up until, I would even argue up until New Teen Titans, you had some bland and...
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, this is exactly why, you know, because this is the era I grew up in, so this is why I gravitated towards Marvel at this time. Mm-hmm. For me, no, understand that, you know, kid logic here, but the Marvel stories seem like the more grown-up stories.
Right.
Whereas the DC stuff was just for kids. You know, very, very Super Friends. If you look at TV, it's Super Friends kind of thing. They're fine, but they just seem like that's the kiddie stuff.
Right.
I wanted the real story. So something like this is exactly what I was drawn to.
And what it did was pull DC out of its days.
Yeah. And that's what really pushed them towards the Crisis on Infinite Earths, to try to condense and consolidate their whole, you know, everything in their universe to start telling stories like this.
Exactly. And you did not see anything on the stands at that time that was like the New Teen Titans.
Well, definitely not from DC.
Definitely not from DC, but even in Marvel at that point, because I think this is when Marvel started to slip a little bit. And I think DC, with this series and moving forward, DC took the New Teen Titans and this style of storytelling and thought to themselves, well, we can do something different. They also said, hey, this George Perez and Marv Wolfman guy worked together pretty well, so maybe we should do an event.
Mm-hmm.
Which, let's be honest, the first true event comic in Crisis on Infinite Earths.
I don't know. Kree Skrull War was good.
Whether we celebrate or curse them for what Crisis on Infinite Earths begat, because let's be honest, Secret Empire is a direct result of Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah. You got to take it as, you know, what it is, because Crisis on Infinite Earths had a point. It not only was a really good story, but it, you know, it did exactly what Rebirth is doing now.
Right.
Which is, you know, stories are getting a little out of hand. Let's bring all everything in. We'll keep all the good stuff that we like. Jettison all the storylines that maybe were going a little off base there, and really just get the whole line focused,
which is what they did, and that held for a little while.
It's funny, it held for a little while until you get people like Grant Morrison and various others who say, you know what, I'm just going to do my own thing,
which is fine as well. We're getting a little off topic, but yes, yeah. I mean, like Grant Morrison with Multiversity.
Well, I'm just talking about like Animal Man from like back in the day.
Or Animal Man, or like the Rise of Vertigo.
Right. Well, that's
Vertigo was not Vertigo. You know, Hellblazer existed before Vertigo. Alan Moore's run on Swamp Thing existed way, maybe a decade before Vertigo.
But this, to swing it back to Teen Titans, this type of storytelling was really unique and interesting in the fact that it still held the old style type of comic from the 60s and 70s, but it was modernizing how that type of story is told.
We had that kind of goofy dialogue that, let's be honest, as comic book fans, there's a lot of goofy dialogue in comics. It had the goofy dialogue, but it took the goofy dialogue and moved it into an interpersonal nature.
Well, how, you know, this is an example of how Marvel's style is sort of seeping into DC. And a lot of that has to do with Wolfman. I mean, Wolfman worked for both companies, and I think he's doing the best of both worlds here.
So one of the things that I loved about this series, and also 80s comics in general, is the thought balloon.
Yes, something that's not used very much at all.
No, the thought balloon has basically been done away with. And what I loved about this arc of the new Teen Titans is how the thought balloon allows for internal dialogue that happens in a more rapid sequence.
No, I agree. And, you know, in today's style, you get, those different colored boxes. That's more of a narration. Mm-hmm. You kind of see that or feel it as more of a voiceover rather than an internal dialogue.
Right.
And I kind of miss that. It could be over, believe me, in not necessarily in this comic, but in general, it could be overused. But when used well, it enhances the story, and it allows for us to see a character's motivations.
Well, exactly, because I would rather hear someone's thoughts, or I would rather read someone's thoughts.
Yeah, it enhances the story, it lets you know what's going on, and it provides a little humor to break stuff up.
Occasionally, yes.
So I know exactly what you mean, and I do miss the thought balloon as well. I wish there could be a combination of the two, you know, that voiceover dialogue box and the more intimate thought balloon.
Well, and I think that works well with this particular arc because much of this arc is interpersonal, and much of this arc is not so much about the action, even though Perez renders some amazing action sequences. Much of what the new Teen Titans is about is character development. And I think the thought balloons lend themselves to the character development that some modern comics don't really do.
And not just development, but the relationships between the two.
Right. Because you have the internal.
Exactly. And that's something that, you know, again, very unique to comics, is that you can have someone outwardly saying something, but be thinking something completely different.
Which is what I love, like, to pull it back into this particular arc, is that we look at the character of Terra, who is the traitor. Yeah. She is working with Deathstroke, the Terminator, and she absolutely despises, like everybody on the Titans team. And you think as you're reading the arc, oh, she's just going to come around. She's just going to come around because she's been shown kindnesses. But all of the kindness that she has shown, like when you read the internal thought balloons, they don't make any effect upon her at all.
Well, yeah. I mean, Terra's fall, her betrayal is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, she teeters between being a sympathetic character and a full-on psychopath.
Right. Yeah. And it's non-sentimental. I think that is one of the most interesting things about this, is that her traitorism and her fall are not done in a sentimental manner. You have at the end, they build her a statue and they present her as a hero, but is not done in the sentimental way that we are used to.
Well, that, again, the ending is fascinating as well, because the fact that Terra is portrayed as evil, just not manipulated, not mind-controlled, just evil.
She's just evil. Raven senses this throughout the series.
Right. And it's interesting how the Titans try to find excuses for that. They try to explain it away, but they can't comprehend how this could happen.
Right. And even the one person, Garth Logan, who could potentially figure this out because he's the closest to her, both in age and in relationship, when he's not being creepy predator
level. Beast Boy is a perv.
Beast Boy is a perv. I'm sorry, Changeling.
Changeling.
Yeah. Right, yes, Changeling. Not Beast Boy, Changeling. But even he doesn't... It seems like he senses something, but he doesn't quite make the connection.
He doesn't want to believe it.
He doesn't want to believe it because technically he is a teenage boy.
Yeah. But this, I mean, this exemplifies, though, why... It exemplifies why they are heroes. They see and will find the best in others, even the bad guys. But it also shows that they're very, very young, and they're in denial that sometimes there's just bad in the world, and sometimes the bad guy is just a bad guy.
Right, but this is what is great about the series, and this is why I think this is important.
It's heavy stuff for a kid's comic.
And it also allows for the humanity, because you see, like, Cyborg and Dick Grayson and whoever else to allow Terra every possible excuse.
They go
even
to great.
Deathstroke the Terminator doesn't realize that she is absolutely batshit crazy.
Right. They go to great lengths to show this conflict. I mean, mm-hmm. She's part of the team. She's accepted. The Titans do love her, and not just in a Beast Boy pervy way, but she is family to them. So that's like that makes her betrayal all the more
because
devastating.
You keep waiting for her redemption. You keep waiting for her to see all the good things that have been done for her.
Yeah, I waited for that, you know, that cliched moment of her to say, "But no, I do love you and I am part of the team.
And I am not going to be a traitor and I am going to sell out Deathstroke the Terminator."
Right, and Wolfman and Perez don't shy away from
right
the fact.
Thing.
Yeah, Wolfman, they don't shy away from the fact that she's just bad.
It's a very unsentimental take.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's just bad. Yeah. The only sentiment you get is at the end when they present her as a hero and build a statue for her. But that is not done for her sake. It is done for her family's sake.
Yeah, and for the sake of the Titans as well, so that they can cope with that loss by not acknowledging it, basically.
Right. Because the only one that was on to her was Raven.
And no one trusts Raven.
And no one trusts Raven for a lot of good reasons that we see in previous and future issues.
Yeah. They just say, that's so Raven. So, all right. Something that disturbed me.
Okay.
How old is Terra? Terra?
Oh, are we going to talk about Deathstroke's potential sexual relationship with Terra?
They flat out say that they're lovers.
Yes. Yes, they do. And they talk... numerous points about she is, I think at one point she's referred to as 14. At one point she's referred to as 15. At one point she's referred to as 16.
Well, she's growing up quite fast.
She's growing up quickly.
Yeah. That struck me as, you know, disturbing. Because Slade, well, it's not like Slade's a teenager too. He's what?
He's an old dude.
This is set in 82. He was in Vietnam. He's got to be middle-aged.
Right.
And
well, his son Jericho is at least 18 or 19.
Yeah. Was that intentional or was it just something that do you think it's something that they just sort of glossed over, a missed detail, basically?
I think it was glossed over, missed detail. I think that there was, some of it involves Garth Logan, a.k.a. Beast Boy, a.k.a. Changeling, who is also a teenager, who is also possibly a sexual predator.
I think that was meant to be. When I read it, it comes across. It doesn't come across well. Doesn't hasn't aged well.
No.
But I think that was just meant to be. Oh, isn't he just a goofy little horn dog kid?
Right.
Yeah, but that's behavior that we probably wouldn't. We'll be frowning on in today's climate.
It's frowned upon in this establishment.
But I don't. It seems weird because at many times during the course of the storytelling, Wolfman gets the fact that they're kids. Incredibly right. Spot on, like, you know, he gets it right. But then there's little details, especially about sex and the way Starfire is fawned over for her outfit.
Yeah,
it's disjointed in its tone, and I found that a little off-putting. And I want to just just hand wave it away. You know, it's 1982; it's no big deal. It was a different time.
Yes, it's 1982, and we had a lot of that in 1982. But at the same time, it's like. We don't accept that now.
Exactly. And I'm not sure we did accept it back then either. I don't know.
Well, no, it was never acceptable. It was I guess I'm making the distinction between acceptable and allowed.
Yeah.
In the same way that, as we've mentioned earlier, how many dick jokes are there involving Dick Grayson throughout that series? Now, some of those are innocent, but some of those, Marv Wolfman and George Perez knew they were doing dick jokes.
Yeah, they definitely leaned on the penis humor.
Yeah, and some of that is innocent. I mean, again, at the end of the day, Dick Grayson's name is Dick Grayson. But there are panels, there are parts of dialogue, and I'm not going to point them out, where you're just like, man, Marv Wolfman knew what he was writing right there.
I'm sure he did. I'm sure he was trying to slip that past the censors and past the editors. But you know
what? Every writer who has ever had to deal with Dick Grayson, from the beginning onwards to Steve Orlando, currently, has made dick jokes.
Yeah. And, you know, you kind of want him to cut that out. You know, circumcise those jokes out of it. Oh. But I know. I'm torn between, it actually is kind of funny, to, yeah, I think you're overdoing it a bit. But let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on to the actual story. Which
there's so much that is good.
There's so much to unpack, and we would have to do 5 hours to unpack everything that has happened in just these brief 7 issues. And the first thing I would like to say is I am thrilled. I think we should all be thrilled by the fact that they treated an annual.
Yes.
Remember when annuals meant something?
Yes, they actually used to tie into parts of the story.
Right. And so in this story arc, the annual is actually
the conclusion of the story.
The conclusion of the story. Not just the conclusion, but the action-packed, information-packed conclusion of the story. In these issues, because the Judas Contract is basically 3 individual issues and an annual. And the first 2 issues, basically, the first issue, I think it's 43 or 42, issue 42, there's not a lot of superhero dynamics going on in the first issue. It's all about, we see Cyborg ice skating. We see Wonder Girl and Coriander Stargirl sparring to right. practice their craft. We see Wonder Girl and her future husband interacting with the rest of the cast. That first issue is all about
it's setting up
the reaction of all of the individuals with each other.
I get what you're getting. It's not even an interlude, because it's also setting up Tara's betrayal and what the impact right. of that betrayal is going to be.
Because you see, with her and Garth supposedly working out, and then Tara loses her shit.
Right. Well, and also, when they have that nice little walk in the park, in the snowy park, and Changeling, I keep wanting to call him Beast Boy, Changeling actually opens up to her and says, you know, the reason I do all this horn dog pervy stuff is because I'm not comfortable with myself, you know? And that's really important, and it's really a mature storytelling device.
It is. And you see that over the next 2 issues as well. So issue 2, issue 43, is basically the entirety of issue 3, or issue 43, is Dick Grayson being a detective trying to solve the mystery, because all of the Titans have been kidnapped at this point, or captured at this point, by Deathstroke, and he is taking them back to Hive. So the entirety of that issue is essentially setting up Dick Grayson as the next great detective vis-a-vis Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, and I think that gets lost, not only in Dick Grayson, but also in Batman stories, that he is a detective,
right?
First and foremost. Yes, he dresses as a bat, and he has some parent issues, but he is first and foremost a detective, and he has taught that to Dick Grayson.
Right.
And I love that that's been active. I love the way that this story is told. How the, you know, we don't just see Slade taking down all the Titans. we see Grayson investigating that.
Investigating and finding out.
It's his perspective as he pieces the story together.
Exactly.
In a similar way, the previous issue, the way we see all the interactions between all the Titans, all the personal interactions, we also see Tara collecting that information through her camera contacts.
Yeah, there's a scene where like she and Slade Wilson are talking and they talk about how she has like a contact lens with a camera. I love comics because you have a contact lens with a camera.
And eventually that's going to happen.
Yes.
But they also have a building that's shaped like the letter T.
Yes.
Which is very interesting.
Which is kooky. I mean, no one would do that because you're just screaming, hey, here's our secret headquarters.
Yeah, our secret headquarters shaped like a T. But in all honesty, though, this is the way that this story is told is brilliant.
Yes.
And a lot of that comes from Perez and how his story, like we were talking about before, his mosaic panel layouts are just perfect for this.
Oh, yeah. Because there is so much that's going on. Again, when I gave the intro, essentially the story is like heroes get captured, other heroes come in, save the heroes, we're done. But it's so much more than that.
Oh, absolutely. And because it could just be, like you just said, the heroes come in, they have a big fight, they're betrayed by one of their team members, but they add consequence to this. It's not simply Tara betrays the group. No, they actually feel for her. I mean, you feel the impact of that betrayal.
Right.
On each of the members.
But you also feel the impact of Tara, who is clearly insane. And you also see how she is manipulating the characters.
Yeah. And that's why I find this fascinating that like her fake persona is the good side. That's an amazing way to show a villain, you know, because usually it's, you know, they're being manipulated in some way, but she's not. She's just a crazy person who's pretending to be sane. That's something very unique.
Right. So let's talk about Nightwing.
Okay. I never knew the origin of Nightwing, believe it or not. I mean, I knew he really? Was Dick. I knew he was Dick Grayson's Robin, all grown up. But I had never read this arc and how he, you know, chose the name Nightwing. And so this was actually a very pleasant surprise. I knew it was going to happen, but I didn't know how it was going to happen. So it was really a pleasant surprise. What wasn't a pleasant surprise? That costume.
Oh, the costume is so bad.
Yeah,
it's so bad in so many ways. But you know, that costume lasted for a decade.
I know,
or more.
It's as if Donny Osmond joined a prog rock band.
Yeah. And the best part, like he talks about how he came about not just the persona as Nightwing, but the costume. And he brings in like Batman and Superman.
That's some kind of Kryptonian persona.
At some point he says that it's based on his appreciation of Superman.
Yeah, I just want to say Superman going, hey, 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 leave me out of this.
And then you see the costume and the name. How is this possibly remotely connected to Superman?
I don't know, but that is well, a that
I
is
mean,
a
first of all, dive. how is that possibly connected to anything other than
Studio 54, maybe.
Studio 54. Yeah. I mean, that costume is so terrible in so many ways, but that costume is iconic.
I guess.
Right? Because that costume lasted for a long time.
Which is surprising to me.
There's that great scene. It's in issue 44.
Where he descends the staircase.
Where he descends the staircase and he's Nightwing. I am Nightwing. Because Dick Grayson has given up being Robin. And he spent 6 issues being emo about the fact that he is not Robin anymore, but who is he? Where is he going? What is he doing? I am Nightwing. Vengeance of the Sky, or whatever it was, right?
Just amazing.
It is important to note that this happened in this story arc.
Right. Dick Grayson, I didn't know that. Yeah, so that, like I said, pleasant surprise. I was very excited to say, oh, look, here's where he becomes Nightwing. And as well as that, we also get the origin of Slade Wilson's The Terminator.
Yes, this is why this particular arc is so important. Mm-hmm. You have the introduction of Nightwing. You have Slade Wilson's origin.
And Jericho.
And Jericho's origin. And Jericho is a character, like we mentioned earlier, where I feel like the Beast is not treated well. I think Jericho has not been treated well going forward either.
And just as an aside, his costume, it seems like he's really into D&D.
Well, sure. But this was 1983.
Yeah.
In the same way that Nightwing's costume was wackadoodle.
Yes.
How could Jericho's costume not be any less wacky?
I got a big kick out of how, you know, he projects himself into Dick Grayson and makes him punch himself.
Right.
I got a vibe of I have a big brother. Why are you hitting yourself? I was getting flashbacks. I thought he was going to give himself a Charlie horse. But the origin of Slade Wilson's Deathstroke the Terminator. I'm really glad they eventually dropped that. But
yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure if that's canon anymore.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that isn't canon anymore because of the various crises.
Right, and the reboots and the rebirths and what have you. I think going into what it was a couple years later, Crisis on Infinite Earths, I think these were important origin stories.
Oh, absolutely.
And they present him as not quite the dick that you thought he would be later on in his career. That has also been reversed now in the new 52, or the Rebirth 52.
Rebirth. The Rebirth 52.
I can't keep track of which 52 we're on.
The Rebirth 52 crises. There's something, you know, it's very telling about the politics of Marv Wolfman, that when he was a soldier, he throws in the line, when defending your country was an honor. Wow, way to throw that in there. And part of his training was to learn Mao Zedong's guerrilla tactics.
Oh, yeah, the guerrilla, it was Adeline. Adeline was like, my father served in Mao Zedong's...
Yeah, his guerrilla army.
Army, and so I'm going to teach you these things. And nobody blinked an eye. Nobody was like, oh, well, her father served in Mao Zedong's army. So maybe this particular individual might have some complicated issues.
You think? But and then there's also, during his training, they train with real bullets. Who does that?
Oh, I'm not fine with that. I'm fine with training with real bullets. I mean, this is comics.
Yeah. When you fail that program, you really fail that program.
But that's comics. I mean, you know, you can kill the guy in the red shirt.
But I love how they do. He's just not. He doesn't start out as a bad guy.
Right.
He slowly degenerates.
He's not even presented as specifically a bad guy in this arc.
No, I mean he is.
He's completing a contract, but he's doing it almost for an honorable reason.
Hey, it's just business.
Right.
Nothing personal.
Now, going forward, Deathstroke is presented as like one of the great bad guys in the DC universe. But in the new Teen Titans, all the nuances that happen in the new Teen Titans is Slade Wilson is not necessarily the big evil. The big evil is Terra.
Yeah, which is also a great twist, is that you think, that's actually how I thought this was going to end, was that Slade Wilson was going to be the big bad. Terra was working with him, but at the last moment was going to have a change of heart and save the Teen Titans.
Right. You waited for that. You waited for Terra to have the change of heart.
And it never came. And in fact, it was
the opposite.
Deathstroke that had the change of heart due to his son.
Due to Jericho.
It's really a fascinating story. I enjoyed this quite a bit. Also, Deathstroke has a great put down, which I'm going to use on a regular basis, which is Vainglorious Dolt. Okay, this is just a complete aside, but in the scene where Changeling gets caught by Deathstroke, we have his maid walk in, and she thinks to herself, why didn't I listen to my mother and become an exotic dancer?
Oh, God. Yeah.
There was so much to unpack it just in that one statement.
Well, this is just right on, I mean, this is, oh, why did you put that in print?
And again, this just gets back to that tone thing where it's very much written as a teen story, Teen Titans.
Right.
And he gets so much of that right. But this sexual innuendo that he keeps throwing in
is really creepy.
Yeah.
It's the one thing I think they would take back if they could.
I think so, too. Well, that's something overall. It feels very modern, while at the same time being very much of its time.
Oh, it's very 1983, 84.
But at the same time, it's still pushing that comic storytelling into the, you know, because right after this is when it starts to get a little bit darker, gets a little bit more mature.
This is when DC started to look at more mature themes.
Yeah. We start to get the British Invasion at this point, which is, you know, your Grant Morrison's or Neil Gaiman's and so forth.
More the Alan Moore's and whatnot, but yes.
Yes, Alan Moore, absolutely. But, you know, they're all basically coming in at the same time. So this type of storytelling is becoming very modern. This is an example of moving away from that silver Bronze Age storytelling and into the more modern type of storytelling.
Absolutely. And I think that part of why the new Teen Titans was such a stellar example at the time it was, and why it is an iconic run by both Perez and Wolfman, is that nobody was doing anything quite like it at the time. I mean, nobody was. And it was like, you move ahead 5 years and it seems quaint. You move back 5 years and it's like, what the hell are you doing?
Exactly. And it's very unique. It's very, I don't know, it's a really fascinating run.
There was nothing like it at the time.
Yeah. Overall, I just think it's an exceptional example of classic comic style, mixing the traditional Silver Bronze Age over-the-top storytelling, as I said, with what will become more modern, more mature tones. And it also mixes that fun and goofiness with some pretty heavy issues, like politics and religion and nature and the nature of evil. It's just all in all, very, very impressive.
Well, and I think you just nailed it. It had everything that folks could love about comics at a time in which comics were like a little depressed.
Yeah, a new renaissance in comics is just over the horizon. And this is an example of what pushed it towards that.
I think exactly.
Okay.
So, Paul, we've covered the new Teen Titans. What is it that you want to talk about next time?
Next time, we'll be doing a special episode in anticipation of the release of the Blade Runner sequel, Blade Runner 2049. We'll be covering the 1982 two-issue movie adaptation by Marvel Comics, written by Archie Goodwin and art by Al Williamson. And we'll also be covering the comic book adaptation of the original Philip K. Dick novel that Blade Runner is based on, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? This is from Boom Studios with art by Tony Parker. So I think that's it for this episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next time, keep reading comics.
Be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag Collected Edition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I think neither of our wives probably view the podcasting part of our lives as a priority.
Yeah.
You and I are like, this is the most important thing I'm doing this week.
Yeah.
Our wives, on the other hand, are like,
Yeah. My God, this is important stuff. I got some serious thoughts and feelings on Teen Titans that need to go out.
You'll see. And then we will continue.
I have to say, I spent most of the time reading this going, Slade Wilson, Deathstroke, Terminator.
Do you do like a voice? When you read comics, do you do a voice in your head?
Yes, I do. Depending on what I'm reading. I tend to read, if I'm reading like really old Marvel, I try to read it like Stan Lee. Oh, wait. One more note I got to put in here is, I love when all the Titans get together, they escape and they have they're all assembling and they yell, Avengers assemble. I mean, Titans together. It's not quite the rallying cry.
No, it's not.
Well, I had a couple of other things I wanted to say, like Operation Waterworks, not exactly the most intimidating name for a evil plan. Operation Waterworks will be taking over Park Place and Broadway. One other thing, Hierarchy for International Vengeance and Extermination.
Yes.
They really, really wanted that to spell Hive.
They did.
Yeah. It's much like S.H.I.E.L.D.
We're talking about New Teen Titans, where every other panel is someone talking about Dick.
That's true. There's so many people who love Dick in that program.
There's a whole panel where Starfire just talks about how much she loves Dick.
It's true. We should probably move on to a different subject.
Okay.